Blog Talk Radio.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
They listen to Inside the Park. Inside the park. The RSV family. My usual suspects with me. Hot baseball topic. We're just going to jump right into it. I always tell them.
Gambling. What do you think about gambling?
It's
not gambling when you know you're
going to
win.
He's not coming out late. The RSV family. You're listening to Inside the Park. Inside the park.
Good evening, listeners. It's good to hear for you to be out here tonight. This is Hank. I'm man in the ballpark by myself tonight. Both Mike and RJ are out on doing road trips. They're scouting prospects for us for our next week's show. So for all of you that's tuned in, listening for our usual banter, we're going to postpone that for tonight. But however, we're not going to leave you high and dry. A lot of good baseball out there, a lot of good baseball talk. I want to first, give a shout out to Matt Cain for the perfect game this week. But what we're going to do this week, since we can't go back and forth like we usually do, we're going to replay some of a couple of interviews that we've had in the past. We're going to replay the Jonah Carey interview from back in April, as well as the Mississippi State University baseball coach, Keith Gooten. We will be replaying both of those interviews. We're going to start with the Jonah Carey interview, and then we're going to go right into the Keith Gooten interview. And then the Inside the Park gang will be back next week with a fresh new show for you, so don't miss out. Okay, so at this time, we're going to go with the Jonah Carey interview.
Welcome to the Real Sports Guys podcast. Jonah Carey, the author of The Extra 2%, which was a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list, recently stopped by to talk to the guys from the Inside the Park crew. During his interview, Jonah talked about his book, The Extra 2%, Tim Lincecum's recent struggles, how he feels the Detroit Tigers will do this year, as well as his upcoming book on his beloved Montreal Expos. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Remember to check out the Inside the Park show on the Real Sports Guys Network, which comes on every Wednesday at 8:30 Central.
We got Jonah Carey coming on, acclaimed author. This guy is author of The Extra 2%. A book all about the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. I like to call it the new money ball. Jonah, are you there?
I am. You know that by calling them the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, you will be fined $1. My team president, Matt Silverman, that's going to happen. He's going to call you up and take $1 from you.
You know what? And I've read your book twice, and I know better. I'll be getting a letter in the mail and a fine. I would do that when you come on there. How you doing, brother?
I'm good. Everything is good. I'm over at Coors Field. Actually, I'm covering the Rockies and the Giants and watching Tim Lincecum get lit up a little bit, surprisingly.
You know, we were just talking about that. Is something going on with his velocity? What's going on with Tim Lincecum?
Oh, I wouldn't worry too much about it. And I know I heard you guys talking just before you brought me on about this whole idea of the first week and what he do with small sample size and so forth. His velocity is pretty okay. That is something that I would worry about, though, if a pitcher had problems like that. I mean, the guy that's bothering me a little is actually Josh Beckett, because his velocity was down from what it's been in the past, and his location was terrible, too. I mean, it just looked like he was supposed to have a thumb injury, and he sort of wondered, well, was he favoring his thumb, and that was causing him to throw straight and slow, which is a terrible combination. But if you're talking about someone who would make you nervous, well, I don't think Lincecum is the guy, but Beckett might be one of those guys.
Interesting. I think I was reading all over the place in the offseason to watch out for Lincecum, the perceived down year from his standards, and it's funny to see that come to fruition. But I was at that game, the Beckett game in Detroit, and you're like, the ball was flying out of the park that day.
Oh, yeah. And it's a good listen. The Tigers are great. I mean, you talked about your Tigers and how good they are. There's no question about it. They have power hitters up and down the lineup. And there's no shame in giving up home runs to Prince Fielder and Miguel Cabrera. But, you know, maybe you do it once. I don't know if you do it five times. He absolutely got shelled in that game. And, yeah, you saw it live. You can attest. He didn't look like vintage Beckett, that's for sure.
Indeed. And I want to say I'm happy to have you on. I'm a big fan of your book. And
thank you.
Because we're going to talk to you about your book and some of your writing, I'm going to leave alone your projection for my Tigers this year. I won't go into that too tough, but I do want you to know I was reading and I wasn't happy with your projection for my Tigers.
Wait a second. I wrote a column for people who don't know. I write for a site called Grantland.com, and the idea that I wrote about was over-unders for the baseball season. Vegas puts out lines and says, this team's going to win this, and this team's going to win that. My only objection was I didn't think the Tigers would win 94 games. I think they're going to probably run away with the AL Central. I'm just not sure they're a 100-win ball club. I suspect they have a lot of power. Maybe you have a couple holes with the defense and Fister now being hurt and so forth. They're still going to win 90 games. They're still going to be a fine team. I just don't think they're going to be the most dominant team in the history of baseball.
Okay. I can give you that. Did you see the reports coming out of Detroit today that Z Mart may be coming back at the end of the season?
Perfect. So they're going to have 60 H's in the lineup instead of 5. That's tremendous. Good news.
Yeah, I think today's DH Andy Dierks may have a problem with that, but I was more than ecstatic.
Yeah, no, I mean, and he's a likable player and a good player, so we'll see what happens. It actually does create, I mean, I'm partially joking, but I'm partially not. It creates an interesting lineup situation. Who do you put where, and what do you do? Does Zelman sit on the bench? I mean, there are all kinds of scenarios in play with all the numbers that they have. I mean, these are all good hitters, but they have to find positions for all these guys, and it's not the easiest thing to do.
Indeed, indeed. But let's jump into your book. You wrote about the Tampa Bay Rays, and they're taking an interesting approach to winning, if I can say so myself. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the Tampa Rays and what they've done to compete in that tough AL East?
Well, I mean, it's been a lot of things. You know, they're really focusing on under-the-radar methods for winning games. So one of the things that they've been emphasizing for years now is defense. And you know, we had the Moneyball era, and the idea was get on base and hit the PED and steroids era, where the idea was hit home runs. And they had these big fat guys who couldn't really field, but they could hit 30 home runs and walk 100 times. Those are useful players, but the Rays sort of realized, hey, there's no more value in those players. We got to find something else. So they started looking for, you know, guys with diverse skills. They could run a little bit. They could catch the ball. They could play multiple positions. And that's really worked out for them. One of the, maybe the poster child for that is Ben Zobrist, who isn't a burner necessarily, but he'll give you 20 steals. He plays great defense. And not just the one position. He'll play the multiple positions, second base, and in the outfield. He's played some other spots, too. They got him for nothing. They basically got him from Houston in kind of a throw into a trade. He was a good bench player. They decided to stick him in the lineup, and he became Zorilla. He became this power-hitting, all-around steals and defense and power, and just had everything going on. He was this great player. And they just have this uncanny knack for turning up gems like that. They develop good players, too. I mean, Evan Longoria and David Price and B.J. Upton, these are all number one draft choices. These are guys with a strong pedigree, and they've been very good, too. But the ability to sell out the rest of the roster is what really impresses me, because I think the one criticism that gets leveled against the Rays a little bit is, hey, if you suck for 10 years, you can get all these number one picks, and it's really easy. Oh, well, gee, where are the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Baltimore Orioles and the Kansas City Royals? Do they have World Series pennants and I missed it? You know, they're not doing that well, despite the fact that they've sucked for a long time. But the Rays have found a way in that, yes, they draft well, but they just do such a good job of supplementing the roster, too. And I think the other big point is that once they get these guys and they're coming up, they sign them to these contracts. I mean, I don't know, man. These players, it looks like they're just snookered a little bit. Longoria is signed to a 9-year, $48 million contract. I mean, I would love to make $48 million, but for a baseball player of Longoria's stature, that's an unbelievable deal for the Rays. Matt Moore, granted, you know, they gave him job security and financial security 9 innings into his major league career, but they're basically paying him $14 million for 6 years with some club options. That could be another monster deal in favor of the Rays. They're willing to take a risk earlier in guys' careers, but so far all these deals have paid off. You look at Crawford with signs of a long-term deal. That worked out before he ultimately left. Same thing with Shields. Same thing with Longoria and Zobrist and Matt Moore and all these guys. They find talent. They identify talent. They nurture talent. And then they find a way to sign them for much less than anybody else would. That basically is the extra 2%.
And you know, thanks to you and your book, I got to say, when they're not playing the Tigers, I've got Rays fever. I was at the game today. I'm pointing out to my wife, look how they're lining up. You see that shift there? She's like, wow, I've never seen that. And it's kind of like, you know, they get underappreciated. Nobody really ever thinks they're going to win. But it's something that they're doing that just has them there every year. And
yeah, no doubt. Go ahead.
I think you brought that out really well in your book when you talked about, you know, the new front office. They got rid of their old owner, which you really did a great job of making him seem like the villain, so to speak,
against
Anomaly. I mean, I really detested this guy as I'm reading your book. And then I find myself cheering for the Rays to do well with this new front office of Matt Silverman, Andrew Friedman, and Stuart Sternberg.
Yeah, no question. Well, and the thing is, I mean, in my real life, I'm a nice guy. I'm Canadian. I'm a mild-mannered guy. I don't go after people. But this guy, Namoli, I mean, he was a gem, man. I think my favorite, and there are a lot of stories, but my two favorites, number one is he invited a local high school marching band to come sing the national anthem. And they get to the ballpark, and they've got all their band uniforms and everything like that. And they're told, oh, no, you can't get into the stadium unless you buy a ticket. And they were dismissed from the stadium. That was fun. I enjoyed that one. And I think the other one that really caught my eye was this elderly couple that came with the old folks home. They go to the ballpark and show up at the front gate. And this lady's in a wheelchair. She's diabetic. She's 8 years old. She's in a wheelchair with her elderly husband. And the gate agent says, hey, what do you got on that over there in your hand? She says, oh, I got a little, Ziploc bag full of cashew nuts. She's got, whatever, 10, 15 cashew nuts. It's just basically keep her blood sugar up, she says. I'm sure that's fine. He goes, oh, no, you can't do that. No, you're not allowed to bring anything into the stadium. And she says, well, I mean, I could go with a diabetic coma. I absolutely have to have it. I need to have it close to me just in case. And, you know, it's hard to get the concessions, and just let me hang on to it. The guy says no. And basically, the husband intervenes, and a fight ensues. So there's this 20-year-old obnoxious guy who's arguing with this 80-year-old guy over whether his 80-year-old wife, who's in a wheelchair and is diabetic, can bring in a bag full of cashew nuts into the stadium. They kick him out of the stadium, make him go back and wait on the old folks bus for 3.5 hours while the whole game is going on and all their old folks' friends are in the stadium. That was Vincent Namoli. So honestly, anybody would have been an upgrade from those guys. But yes, it is the case that Stu Sternberg, the new owner, and Matt Silverman, the team president, Andrew Friedman, the general manager, do a great job on the field and off the field. They market very well. They find ways to, you know, turn over revenue sources. They don't draw all that well, which is unfortunate. But they do these little things that help here and there. And, of course, their ability to produce and retain talent is really second to none for a team with that low payroll.
Now, the new front office, Silverman, Friedman, and Sternberg, where did they come from? Where are they getting these principles from?
So they're Wall Street guys, and the subtitle of the book, The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Team from Worst to First, which sounds very fancy, but it's pretty simple. The two of them, Sternberg and Silverman, came from a company called Goldman Sachs, which basically rules the world. It's a big investment bank. And they did all kinds of things, mergers and acquisitions, major deals, and they worked together, and they were making a lot of money, especially Sternberg. In fact, the company that Sternberg was with, which was bought by Goldman Sachs, he was one of the six partners. They were bought for $6 billion back in 2000. So Sternberg obviously has a knack for the deal and could do good things. And the two of them were working together, and then ultimately, you know, we're about to leave Goldman, and we're trying to figure out what to do. And Sternberg said to Silverman, hey, would you be willing to try to help me pursue buying a baseball team? And Silverman, who was a young guy in his 20s and loved baseball, grew up a Cubs fan, said, sure, sounds great, let's do it. So they went ahead and did that. They bought the club. And Silverman was friends with Friedman. And Silverman introduces Friedman to Sternberg, and they get to talking, and it's just obvious that they're birds of a feather, and they get along very well. And Friedman was also a Wall Street guy. He worked for a private equity firm, which basically means that you're investing in kind of up-and-coming companies before they go public. You're almost like a venture capitalist, I guess, in some ways. You're trying to find hidden sources of talent, hidden sources of value. It's the same idea with baseball and with private equity. And so they felt that Friedman would be a good candidate. Also a big baseball guy, limited baseball experience. He could play at Tulane. He was a pretty good center fielder, but hadn't done anything from a managerial standpoint. So they sort of become partners. Harper becomes partners with Namoli for a little while, and they're both owning a part of the team. And Silverman and Friedman get their feet wet. And then eventually, Sternberg buys the team outright, and then the young guys take over. So when Friedman took over as general manager, he was 28, and I think Silverman was also 27 or 28 when he was the president of a major league franchise. But, I mean, you can't argue with success. You know, you could say, well, I don't know if I want to entrust the franchise to these young, young guys. But, I mean, heck, they've made the playoffs 3 out of 4 years. They're looking very good this season. Despite the fact that they are struggling to draw, they're still profitable. They're hoping to build a new stadium. I mean, good things are happening. There was never anything good that had happened with this team once they had that initial opening day in 1998. It was pretty much downhill after that until the new regime took over, and now there are lots of good things happening.
Yeah, I love it. I love the new regime. I love what they're doing. But something caught my eye in the offseason. I saw the Houston Astros make a run at Friedman, the GM over there. Do you think he would consider leaving the Rays? And if so, what do you think it would take to get him out of there?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Rays, and I didn't make a huge deal about it, I mentioned it in the book, but I didn't go into that much depth, is the fact that Matt Silverman and Andrew Friedman do not have contracts. They have a handshake agreement with Sternberg. And Sternberg just says, okay, here's what I'm going to pay you. And they say, okay, that's cool. Just wire it to my bank account. We're all good. I mean, this is, you know, beyond just a business relationship. They're very, very close. There's extreme trust. I mean, you know, I don't care what kind of job you have. You know, if you're cleaning houses or pushing papers or whatever, you know, if you're making $30K, you want a contract, let alone if you're making, you know, a couple million dollars a year. But that is the case with these guys. And so I think that level of trust and intimacy and having an owner who is interested and invested in the team and communicates with those guys, but not someone who meddles, not a Peter Angelo situation, is just ideal. So Friedman's from Houston. That's why part of the reason the Houston job was attractive. Obviously, it would have been a chance to rebuild a franchise in a big market, actually. Houston has a lot of potential financially. And he's from there, and he could have gone back and, you know, done well in front of his family and friends. And all that's very attractive. But, gee, I mean, if you work in an ideal working situation where your boss supportive of you and absolute trust, and you don't have to worry about anybody looking over your shoulder. I mean, that's invaluable. Maybe you would rather live in New York, or maybe you'd rather hang out with your family and friends in Houston, or maybe you'd rather see what, I don't know, Kansas City is like, whatever. But, you know, the bottom line is, to have that kind of environment, I think we'd all kill for that, right? I mean, wouldn't it be great to have that kind of boss and that kind of workplace, and you go into work every day and you're happy? That is what Matt Silverman and Andrew Friedman have. And that's why I think it's possible that eventually they go somewhere else. But honestly, I'm not sure that would happen until Sternberg leaves. If Sternberg sells the club, all bets are off, because I think Friedman and Silverman could go too. But as long as Sternberg owns the Rays, I have a hunch that those two other guys might hang around for a while.
I hope they do, because like I said, I'm having fun watching them. You mentioned in the Moneyball era when guys were, everybody, all the teams were looking for guys who were getting on base. And now we've got the extra 2%, and it's letting all the teams know about these Wall Street principles. Have you seen any other clubs using these Wall Street principles? And if so, who's doing it well, and who should probably go on to something else?
Well, this idea of Wall Street principles is pretty broad, right? I mean, we're just basically talking about uncovering value, and every team tries to do that to some extent. I will say the one front office that impresses me is the Toronto Blue Jays, and they get a lot of credit in the kind of analytical circles for what they've done. And it manifests itself in many ways. I mean, you know, obviously they're trying to draft well and develop well and sign good contracts. Jose Bautista signed a $65 million contract. I mean, Jose Bautista might be the best hitter on planet Earth. He's only making $65 million. That's pretty good. You know, Ricky Romero signed to a contract where he's probably going to be a little bit underpaid, and the Jays are benefiting from that. So they do a good job with all that stuff. But they do these little things. You talk about these extra 2% advantages. One of the things the Jays did last year, they stockpiled relief pitchers. Not studs, not guys making, you know, $15 million a year who are big-time closers, but just pretty good relief pitchers. They didn't pay them all that much money. But because of the weird free agent compensation rules in baseball, by signing all these guys to one-year contracts, you let them pitch if it's well. Most of these guys pitch pretty well. And then at the end of the year, you collect all these draft picks because they leave. Someone else finds them, you get compensation. So as a result, the Jays ended up with a whole bunch of picks in this last draft. In fact, the two teams that had the most picks by far were the Rays and the Jays. I think the Rays had 12 of the top 89 picks, I want to say. That's by far the most in the history of the draft. It's never happened before. Well, the Jays had something like 7 of the first 60, too. They had a bunch as well. So they're getting those tricks. The tricks that the Rays are doing, the Jays know what's going on, too. And I'll tell you what makes the Jays maybe scarier than the Rays in some ways. I don't know if you've ever been to Toronto. Toronto's a huge city, man. It's huge. It's probably about the fifth biggest metropolitan market in North America, maybe fifth or sixth. It's just gigantic. And so it sets up all this potential where huge city. In the past, they filled that stadium. SkyDome once drew 4 million fans back in their heyday in the 90s. So that's in place, just the number of people and potential enthusiasm. And the fact that they're owned by Rogers Communications, which is like being owned by AT&T. It's a massive telecommunications conglomerate. It basically controls Canada. It's almost like a monopoly. So you've got money from the corporate side. You play in this huge city, and you're run by guys who really, really know what they're doing. I mean, it's like the Rays on steroids, basically. I would be, frankly, a little bit concerned if I'm a fan of the Yankees, the Red Sox, or the Rays, that the Jays are going to come up and bite me pretty soon, because it's getting there. They're not quite there. I don't know that they're going to make the playoffs yet, but I think they're on their way, and good things are going to happen in Toronto.
I've been to Toronto. I tell people it's like the New York of Canada. I mean, the city's amazing. It's beautiful. It's clean.
Yep.
And, when it comes down to free agency, I don't know many players who, if you go to Toronto, I mean, you ultimately end up loving it. But
yep.
They're telling me I got to wrap up soon, so I want to ask you a couple rapid-fire questions.
Sure.
We've talked a lot about Tampa needing a new stadium and how they're not drawing well. And, they don't have a lot of money to compete, so they have to do some innovative things.
Yep.
If Tampa does get a new stadium and they start drawing and they're making money, what happens to the Rays? And I know that's a loaded question, but what happens to the Rays if they become a team that's drawing money and back in the house?
The thing is, it's a hard hypothetical to answer only because the time frame is so far off. Let's say that tomorrow they said, okay, I think we're going to build a stadium. From the time that you actually conceive the idea and the location to the time that you're literally throwing the first pitch, we're talking minimum of 5 or 6 years. And they're not at the stage where they know where it's going to be built or how it's going to be financed and all that. So to ask what the Rays are going to be doing, it's tough because realistically, we could be talking 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Stu Sternberg might have long since sold the team. Evan Longoria could be, 37 years old on his last leg playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates. I mean, this could be a totally different situation by then. So I just think that makes it a little bit more challenging to try to project. Now, having said that, obviously, if you have more revenue, it lets you do more things. I think what would end up happening is a team like the Rays or any other team in that situation would maybe look to try to, buy free agents on the open market. But I think the bigger thing is they wouldn't necessarily let their own guys go. So, for instance, they let Carl Crawford go, and you could argue maybe that was the right move. Doesn't look like he's doing all that well with the Red Sox. But David Price is going to come up for free agency in a couple of years. I mean, David Price is a great pitcher. He's a great guy. Everybody likes him. I mean, he's someone you'd want to keep with your franchise long term. I don't know that he's going to be a Ray in 2 years. I think that he's probably going to be gone. I think that he might even get traded before free agency because they have pitching depth, and most importantly, because they probably won't be able to afford him. That's the kind of thing that would change, where maybe you wouldn't necessarily go out and spend $240 million on Albert Pujols. But, gee, if you have a chance to re-sign David Price for $100 million for 5 or 6 years, yeah, you'd probably do that. I think it's more just retention of their own star players, because although they have pulled off these great deals early in the careers of Longoria and Moore and those guys, it doesn't work for everybody. Price has demurred, he hasn't signed anything. Maybe Desmond Jennings decides not to sign one of these early contracts. So that's the kind of thing you need to worry about, and when you don't have money, those are the kind of players that you might end up losing.
Yeah, but I hope they get it figured out because, like I said, man, I love watching those guys compete. I know you got to get out of here. You got a game to get back to. But if you could, real quick, tell the listeners about the new book that you're working on.
Sure.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to pick it up when it comes out. But why don't you go ahead and share with the listeners about what you're working on?
Sure. Well, I was born in Montreal and raised and went to college there, and family and friends still live there. And so I was a big Montreal Expos fan, me and 5 other people, basically. And so, I don't know, maybe it'll be read by 5 other people, you and my dad, so that'll be good. We'll get 7 sales. That'll be nice. But anyway, I'm writing a book about the Expos, the history of the team from 1969 till 2004, which is as long as they existed. And it's a little bit of everything. It's going to talk about kind of the history of the city and how the team came into existence and how all that happened, down to the players. I've already interviewed guys like Kim Raines and Tim Wallach and Cliff Floyd, some really good players from their history. I've got Randy Johnson on my list, and Larry Walker, and Marquise Grissom, and Moises Alou. And I think that it's fun to just hear from major leaguers, really good ones, about what was it like playing in that city, and tell me about your baseball experiences and all that. But it'll be more than that. It'll be the story of the city, the story of the players, the story of why it didn't work in Montreal, and maybe a little bit of personal stuff, too. I don't usually write I, and I'm not a big ego guy in my writing or in my work. But my editor has tried to impress on me, hey, listen, you're writing about the Expos, it's a personal experience, go ahead and do that. So it'll be a little bit of everything. If you're into just a straight sports book, that'll be there. If you're into business and politics, that'll be there. And if you're into kind of a little bit of a, you know, half memoir, I guess that's probably going to be in there too. So we feel like it'll be a cool project, and it's going to come out not for 2 years. It's still got a ways to go. Comes out in the spring of 2014.
Okay, we'll be looking forward to it. Do you see baseball returning to Montreal?
Oh, I don't think it's going to happen. I think that ship has failed, and I've come to terms with it. It's a lovely city. I love going back, but, you know, I live here in Denver, and I'm happy to hop over to Coors Field and watch games here.
All right, John. Well, hey, we appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. You stepped away from that what looks to be a blowout to talk to us. So we thank you for that. Listeners, if you want to check out Jonah's work, you can find him at www.jonahcarey.com, and that's spelled JonahKerry.com. And he also writes great baseball pieces over at Grantland.com. So do check him out. Jonah, we thank you from the bottom of our heart. We really appreciate you coming on, and we'll be looking forward to that new book.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
All right. That was Jonah Carey. Mike, Hank, what'd you guys think?
That was an incredible interview. You know, I it was just fun to listen to that and just basically how the Rays have built themselves up. You know, it was funny. Someone was in a time capsule, and they was gone from 2007, and they come back now, and they would say, you know what, the Rays are trying to stay good. They say, what do you mean they're trying to stay good? They suck. You know, so just the fact that they have just been good for so long now, that this is an incredible, you know, strategy that you're working. It was fun to hear Jonah really talk about that.
Oh, yeah, I tell you, man, if you haven't read that book, go check it out. I mean, the Tampa Rays are doing all kinds of crazy things. I mean, they're having a tough time getting people to the game, so they hold concerts after the game kind of to bring people in. They're maximizing their assets as only some Wall Street guys can, and it's a fabulous read. If you can check it out, please do. Mike, you got any thoughts on the Rays? You want to change up your perspective on the Rays? What are you thinking?
So I liked the interview. I liked what he had to say. And to me, it just highlights the importance of scouting and player development in a baseball team. And, you know, the teams that do that well, and Jonah brought that point up, that first-round draft picks don't equal talent at the major league level, even keeping talent at the major league level. You know, Pittsburgh and Baltimore being great examples of guys that have just not been able to cultivate their own players. So Tampa Bay has done a great job of drafting, accruing the draft picks, but not only that, but developing those players and getting them to the major league. And that gives teams with not a lot of payroll flexibility the ability to make a choice. And one is to make investment in those players early on, which, you know, Tampa Bay has obviously done. And we've seen that before. That was John Hart's strategy in Cleveland in the 90s with, you know, Albert Bell, Manny Ramirez, and Kenny Lofton and those guys coming through. But then you also have the ability to turn those into trade chips, right? And so they're changing or trading arbitration-eligible and free agency-eligible players for young guys and prospects in other teams. So it all starts with player development. Tampa Bay has done a fantastic job with that. And I think that, more than anything else, has led to their success.
Welcome to the Real Sports Guys radio show on realsportsguys.com. We have a special treat today. We're doing a College World Series preview. We're going to have the head coach of Missouri State University, Coach Keith Gutton, join us to break down the College World Series upcoming action, but also talk about the awesome season that he and his squad just had. Coach Gutton is a 10-time Missouri Valley Coach of the Year over his past 30 years at Missouri State. His squads have averaged 34 wins per year at a 61% clip. He just eclipsed the 1,000 win mark over the course of this season. This season they had 40 wins. They were part of the Missouri Valley Conference that had three teams into the tournament, including them. They had a really nice run in the tournament. Coach, how you doing today?
Doing great, Phil. Good to talk with you.
So, Coach, let's just jump right on in. Let's talk about some of the highlights of this recent season. You all, I would say pitching is probably what defines your season in terms of being, you know, being the key to your success. Your team led the nation in a team ERA at 2.57, as well as shutouts at 11. We'll talk about some of your high-level performers here in a bit that led that pitching staff. But talk a little bit about your season, your keys to success.
Well, I think you hit it on the head, Phil. We don't get to postseason play. We don't get to Miami Coral Gables without that pitching staff was outstanding. We did not have a senior on that pitching staff, Phil. We did lose Pierce Johnson. He was the 43rd player picked overall by the Cubs, so he is gone. We've signed some quality guys, but we had a great staff. I think our three weekend guys, Nick Petrie, who was a first-team All-American pitcher of the year in the Valley, Pierce Johnson, 43rd overall, and Cody Shoemaker, junior transfer, was 8-1. So we had a bullpen was led by Tyler Burgess, freshman All-American, 5-2 with 11 saves. We had a really good staff. We had some older position players. We were not a great hitting club, a little bit inconsistent, to be honest with you, but some guys who really knew how to play mistake-free, and those were the keys to our season, the 40-win season.
Talking a little bit about those two big guys you have in the front of your rotation, Pierce Johnson, 119 strikeouts in 100 innings. Again, he was picked in the second round. Talk about this season and what he meant to your program this year.
Well, I think you got to, you know, everybody asks all year long, who's your number one? Well, we had three number ones, as it turned out. Going in, we thought we had two with Petrie, who was a freshman a year ago, and Pierce, who was a projected very high guy. Pierce ended up missing two starts, missed about 20 days of the season with a muscle strain, and we picked up the slack there. But Nick Petrie, Phil, went over 70 innings at one point without giving up an earned run, and I believe 38 innings consecutively without giving up a run. So we knew going out every day we weren't going to have to score 6 to 8 runs. But I think in reviewing the numbers, when we scored 6 runs, I think we were 32-4. So pitching was the key, and some older position players. All three of those weekend guys were capable of striking out people, which makes your defense a heck of a lot better on a strikeout, believe me. So we ended up fielding, I think, around 970. And we just pretty solid in all phases.
You know, you mentioned Petrie, who finished the season with a 1.01 ERA. He was the player of the year, the national player of the year by Collegiate Baseball, and he was a district player of the year by the College Baseball Writers Association. How much do you contribute his success and the entire pitching staff success to Luke Voigt, your junior catcher, who did a nice job this season?
He did a really good job, Phil. And we're one of the few programs that does allow the catcher to call the game. Coach Evans, our pitching coach, does a tremendous job preparing the pitching staff and the catchers on how to get people out. I think that's a real strength of his, and they take that plan, they go to work with it. We really like the flow of the game when the catcher calls the game, and I think it helps prepare them to go on into professional baseball. Luke, having been here, kind of a 3-year starter for us, really worked well with these guys on the same page, and you know, we let them go with it. And you know, Coach Evans will talk to them between innings, pitcher and catcher, but Luke's got a great feel of how to get out hitters.
You're listening to The Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com. We're here with Coach Keith Gutton, the head baseball coach at Missouri State University, coming off of a NCAA tournament appearance. Coach, you talk a little bit about, you know, how Luke is able to call the game and it helps prepare he and, you know, other things your program helps prepare your players for the professional level. You know, one of the things that we always talk about, you know, we focus on football and basketball is, you know, it's interesting, especially in basketball, we're starting to see more one-and-dones where kids come to school for a year and they move on to the NBA. Well, baseball is always, college baseball has always been very interesting in our eyes because you see kids who, for example, Pierce Johnson, he was drafted in the 15th round out of high school, and that's kind of the cusp there where a lot of kids, if they're drafted a bit earlier than that or right around the 15th round, they may just bypass college. But Pierce, as you mentioned, he came in and improved his stock in a couple of years up to the second round. Talk about how your program helps prepare these young kids to get ready for professional baseball.
Well, I don't know that we do anything magically different, Phil, than others. Coach Evans has had a lot of success taking pitchers and developing them, getting ready. We've got 5 pitchers that have been in the big leagues this year, and he's been real successful with that. But, you know, you're going to recruit a certain type of guy, you hope, with a lot of upside and aptitude, whose arm works good, and you know he's real big on them being very competitive and arming them with 3 pitches to get people out. getting out in the summer, trying to pitch at the highest level and taking care of their arms. So, again, I don't know that that's tremendously different than anybody else. We've been fortunate with some guys. Pierce is not a huge guy. He's like 6'2", 175. He was not very physical coming out of high school, but his arm worked really, really well. And he's a guy that's really gotten better each and every year, and I think he's got a lot of upside.
Coach, you touched on it just a little bit here about summer ball with your players. How do you and your staff help get your players in the right summer ball systems so they can continue to develop in the summertime?
Well, I think we're a little different, maybe, Phil. We wait a little longer. I like to see guys in the fall. I like to see our newcomers in the fall. Now, if you've got a freshman that had tremendous success, like a Tyler Burgess, that's a guy that, is probably going to end up in Cape Cod after his sophomore year. Ironically, he ended up there after his freshman year because there was a need with a particular club we had a connection with. But, Cody Shoemaker, for instance, he threw approximately 100 innings. He didn't go out this summer. He was a little tired. He threw once a week all year for us, but we chose to keep him at home and make sure he was okay. So it varies a little bit. If you've got a freshman that hasn't thrown much, he needs to continue to develop. You're going to get him out. And the nice part is, of course, there are wood bat leagues, and many of the leagues now have stipulations on innings pitch or number of pitches. So, I don't think you have to worry anymore about sending guys out and having them come back not healthy.
You're listening to the Real Sports Guys on RealSportsGuys.com. We're here with head coach Keith Gutton of the Missouri State University Bears in Springfield, Missouri. Coach, talk a little bit about past coaches you've had or coaches, managers in general who have helped shape your coaching philosophy.
Well, I think the guy for me was Bill Rowe. He was the guy I played for here. It was then Southwest Missouri State, and that was in the mid to late 70s, and then I became his part-time graduate assistant, volunteer, whatever you like to call it back then when there wasn't very much money. I was with him 3.5 years, and he moved up to athletic director at Southwest Missouri State, and I did a little stint at junior college with a guy named Kirk Champion, who's a coordinator of pitching or player development, coordinator of field work for the Chicago White Sox, and Kirk and I coached together. So Bill Rowe, Kirk on the pitching side, that's what he was. And, I think you pick it up anywhere and everywhere. You attend conventions, you attend clinics, you get your hands on information, you observe successful people and successful programs, and you take a little bit from each and you let it work within your own personality. You've got to be yourself in this business.
Now, Coach, over the past 30 years in Missouri State, as I mentioned here in the open, you've averaged 34 wins per season at a 61% winning clip. Well, a couple of things to be so successful that you probably have to have is recruiting as well as development. Can you talk about your recruiting philosophy and what type of player you look to fit into your system?
Well, we've always been a blue collar. When we started out at Southwest Missouri State in 83, played at a city park, had very little budget, not a lot of scholarship, and that kind of formed our philosophy going forward. We needed gritty guys that wanted to get after it. Weren't interested in frills. Fortunately, now we play in a beautiful facility that we share with the AA Cardinals, and we have the full scholarships. But that kind of formed our philosophy, the type of guy we wanted, the blue-collar guy. And, we've been fortunate. We've had some guys go on and play professionally and have some success. But, we've never been a program that gets the high draft or the high blue chippers that a lot of people pursue. This year's club, honestly, if you look at the eight guys that played every day, between them, they probably had 10 scholarship offers, including one each from us. So baseball's a little different. There's not video. You try to keep guys under wraps. But recruiting has changed immensely, Phil, in the last 10 years with the advent of select baseball and showcase. It's a little harder to hide a guy. It's a little tougher to outwork guys. It's changed recruiting. That's the biggest thing probably that I've seen is the change in recruiting over the years, from being able to dig guys out of small towns and hide guys and develop them to where now everybody knows about everybody.
Now, Coach, you talked about some of your former notable players, and you've had some success getting players to the next level. Ross Detweiler, he played for you all in the mid-2000s. In 2007, he was the 6th overall pick. Talk a little bit about Ross at that point in his development when he played for you at Missouri State.
It was interesting. So I go back to, we signed Ross out of high school. He's from Wentzville, outside of St. Louis. And I can remember watching him pitch after his senior year, and I had a good friend who was scouting at the time, and I got to the game, and he was leaving the game, and this is a very well-respected guy that I really, one of the better scouts in the Midwest, if not the country, and he said, I think I'm going to let him go. It was right before the draft. He said, I think I'm going to let him go to school. I think he needs that development. And I'm thinking to myself, thank you. But he actually, not from that club, but he went undrafted out of high school. He turned down about $100,000 at the end of the summer of his senior in high school and came to school. And, you know, Ross was very thin, had an arm that worked really good, was quick. And he just kind of bought into Coach Evans and his philosophies. He got stronger, better, and very competitive kid. And he went from being undrafted in high school to sixth player pick in the country.
To some of our listeners out there that may not be familiar with college baseball in terms of the draft eligibility, if a kid is drafted out of high school and then when he can reenter the draft, if he chooses to go professional before then, can you break that down a little bit? And for our listeners that may not be as familiar with it.
Yeah, if you attend a four-year school, then you are again eligible for the draft after your third year of college or if you turn 21. Those are the two parameters by which you're eligible. If you go to a junior college, you can be eligible for the draft. You are eligible for the draft after your first year and your second year if you return to junior college. And that's one of the reasons why some baseball guys pick the junior college. They want to stay eligible for the draft each year.
Yeah, Harper, the rookie phenom with the Nationals, he did that, didn't he?
That is correct. He actually, from my understanding, graduated high school early, went to junior college, participated there for a year, and then became the first overall pick.
Another player that was produced by your program was Ryan Howard, the rookie of the year with the Phillies, 2006 NL MVP, one of the fastest guys to hit 100 home runs in Major League Baseball, and also to hit the 200 home run mark. Talk a little bit about Ryan when he was playing with you all at Missouri State.
Well, Ryan's really an interesting case. Wonderful guy, great family, and as I tell everybody around here, I made him what he is today, jokingly. And Ryan Howard came to Southwest Missouri State without a scholarship. So after his senior. He was a little bit of a late bloomer. After his senior year of high school, I saw him in St. Louis at a tournament, and I thought, oh my goodness gracious, this guy's really made a jump, and he's going to make more jumps. But we were out of money. It was literally July 1. We were out of money. So 2-3 weeks later, we got him to visit. We put down on paper what we'd give him years 2, 3, and 4. Freshman year, he had 18 home runs and was freshman All-American and on. His second year, we gave him more money than we said we were going to give him. Third year, he had a good year as well, and we didn't have to pay for the fourth year. He wasn't here. Phillies took him in the fifth round. But that was an interesting case. Again, that was a case where, as a little bit before, everybody played showcase and select, and, you know, he kind of fell under the wire a little bit.
That was a pretty nice hunch there, Coach.
Well, the only thing I will say to people is maybe I was smart enough to recruit him, and that's about all the credit I'll take.
All right, let's pay some bills. We'll be right back with you in 60 seconds.
Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So, what did the Real Sports Guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads, PCs, to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today.
Welcome back. RealSportsGuys.com. We're here with Coach Keith Gutton at Missouri State University head baseball coach. Coach, let's move on into the College World Series analysis. The College World Series starts tomorrow, June 15th. And before we even get into the analysis of the team, Coach, you led your team there in 2003 to the College World Series. Talk about the unique setting of the College World Series in Omaha. A lot of times in sports, or for the vast majority, you look at the NBA Finals, you look at the World Series, the Super Bowl, they're at a rotating location. And that's not the case in Omaha. It's there every year. Can you talk about that special environment down there?
Well, I it's interesting, Phil, because when teams get together, they talk about goals and they have chants and they have sayings. They always say Omaha. They don't say necessarily, well, we want to go to the College World Series. So that the city is so ingrained in people's mind and such a partner in the series, everybody talks about going to Omaha. They don't talk, they don't say, well, okay, I want to go to the College World Series. They say, I want to go to Omaha. So that in itself, but being there in 03, and obviously we were an underdog the whole way, but I mean, it was almost surreal, to be honest with you. I mean, I can remember coaching third base there and going, damn, this is pretty good. You know, I mean, I'm going to soak up every second of this. And from a coaching perspective, I think the biggest thing is to do the same things you've done all year. Don't all of a sudden start overcoaching or undercoaching your players. Do what you did. And, you know, it was magical. I mean, it really was. We went to Lincoln and ended up beating Nebraska twice. They were the Big 12 champ. And we went to Columbus and swept Ohio State. And I mean, it's just, you just had that feeling you couldn't lose. You couldn't do anything wrong. And, you know, I truthfully, I think that's where Stony Brook is right now, Phil. I mean, they've had a great year, and they just got the magic. They got the chemistry. They don't think they can be beat. And the people that don't know college baseball kind of think this is a fairy tale, on and on. Let me tell you something. They had six guys that played in Cape Cod last year. They had seven guys that were drafted. This is a very talented team that's playing very well.
We'll come back to Stony Brook because I think that's a very interesting situation. You all even played against them. But let's stick with the 2003 run that you all made to the College World Series. One of my academic mentors, Don Fisher, he's been at Missouri State for 30-plus years. You know, he tells me about just how magical that season was, how the whole community, city, faculty, students just kind of jumped in and went it all in for that run. What do you remember best about that?
Well, that and the uniqueness of the players. I mean, that was quite an interesting group. They played so loose, they played so relaxed. The chemistry was fantastic. Now, you know, winning helps chemistry. Chemistry helps winning. That group was extremely close. We had good leadership. They were very social. I mean, they did everything together. It was back in kind of a different era, and really good group. Now, a talented group. Two of those guys, Sean Markham, making $7 million with the Brewers. And Brad Zidler's got an under 2 ERA with the Diamondbacks today. And Sean was our shortstop and closer. You know, we had seven guys drafted, another signs a free agent. So it was a talented, talented team. I think the thing that set it apart was the chemistry was phenomenal. We had what I call the ingredients for success, great pitching, and older position players. Don't have to be great position players, just have to play mistake-free, and I think Stony Brook's got that as well.
Now, Coach, as we mentioned earlier, you all had an outstanding season, one of three teams from the Missouri Valley Conference to make the tournament. You all made some noise down there in Coral Gables at that University of Miami Regional, beat the host, but you ran up against Stony Brook in that elimination game. Talk a little bit about that game and how you think their success carried them on throughout this tournament.
It was interesting because I said going down there, and I remember saying it on the plane, we've got the best four seed in the country in this tournament. And as I told, in our first meeting with our players after we got picked, I told our guys, seeds mean nothing, names mean nothing. Everybody's good. You got to play good. You got to keep doing what you're doing, and you don't want to change anything. But we got down there and played Central Florida, who was a good ball club. We lost 2-1, left 12 runners on, Petri pitch. Gave up the first home run of the year. It was actually the first batter of the game. Gave up a home run, but we lost 2-1. And so then we scout game two, and Stony Brook beats Miami, and I think beats them 10-2. And, I mean, they're a good, good team. Miami's a really talented team, obviously, as well. So then we get into game two, and we're fortunate we played extremely well and beat Miami by pretty good margins. Got out, I think we got either 5 or 6 or 7 runs in the first inning. And then Stony Brook gets beat, I want to say 10-8, play Central Florida. So Central Florida is the undefeated team. So then we meet Stony Brook, round three, elimination game, and we're up 7-2, 7-3 in the seventh inning. Our guys had a three-hitter, and all three runs they had were unearned, and we had a bad inning. We didn't shut them down. Our bullpen had been great all year, but not that particular game. They put a seven spot on, and they could really swing the bat. Older hitters, very disciplined, don't get fooled, fight off pitches. You saw that if you saw any of the LSU Super Regional. They really do a nice job in the batter's box, and we got beat 10-7 by a really good team. And people said, well, how are they going to do at LSU? Like, I said, they're going to compete. They're going to compete well.
Right.
Because the environment is different in the postseason than it is the regular season. In the regular season, you know, nobody's around. Things are different. But you get in the postseason where umpires come from all parts of the country. You got NCAA officials on site. Games are on TV. They're supposed to be neutral. It's a little different feel when you play in postseason at somebody's place. And you know what? They outplayed them three games and should have won the first two if anybody watched it.
Now, Stony Brook was a four seed in your regional, and for listeners out there that may not be as familiar with college baseball, this is the equivalent to a 16 seed that you see in the NCAA basketball tournament. And they're only the second four seed to make the College World Series since the expansion to 64 teams in 1999. Coach, do you think they may be the next Fresno State, who was a four seed and won it all in 2007?
What I do think is they're going to go in there and play well. I really feel that way. Their number one guy, Tyler Johnson, is a Cape Cod All-Star. He's a guy that throws a lot of ground balls. He's a command guy. He's going to be effective against anybody. He was outstanding in the regional. He was good in the super regional. So he's going to keep them in a game. Now, you know, they're playing UCLA, and UCLA certainly probably one of the top three or four talented teams in the country. So it's hard to predict the outcomes. I just know that I think they will play the same way they've played in the regional and the super regional. I think they'll play the same way in the series.
You listen to Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com. We're here with Missouri State University's head baseball coach, Keith Gutton. Before we let you go, Coach, we want to ask you, can anybody beat South Carolina, who's won the last two tournaments?
Well, you know, whoever wins that other bracket, Phil, is going to be playing outstanding baseball. So to answer that question, yes, they can. Now, you know, that could be UCLA. Florida State and Arizona, great offensive clubs. They probably hit better than anybody else in the Supers, of course. One good pitcher can shut that down. But, yeah, I think they can. Now, having said that, you know what winning a two-year show does for your confidence and the ability to handle pressure. So they're the prohibitive favorite, but, sure, it's baseball. Anything can happen.
Head coach Keith Gutton, Missouri State University. Well, Coach, we want to thank you for coming on to our show. You did an excellent job with the analysis. It was so great for myself and our listeners to hear about the successful season that you had in Missouri State this year. Again, Coach, continued success, and thanks again for joining the Real Sports Guys.
Phil, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And always, we'll be back on the air live this coming Tuesday to break down the NBA Finals. And also on Wednesday at 8:30 p.m., RJ, Hank, and Mike will be on to talk about baseball on their weekly Inside the Park show. Check us out in iTunes by searching Real Sports Guys or by going to our website at realsportsguys.com. This is Phil T signing off for the Real Sports Guys. Until next time.
All right, so we're back. We've got a few minutes left before the end of the show. I want to just go ahead and do my little dog of the week for the week.
Cat's still going crazy in there. And I told our players, you need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs.
I think I mentioned it a little earlier this when the show started before the interviews with a pitching staff of Madison Baumgartner and Tim Lincecum.
Matt Cain threw a perfect game for the San Francisco Giants. And in this year where we are seeing so much just crazy baseball for it to be so early in the year, we've had two perfect games already with Phil Humber throwing one for the White Sox. We've seen a combined no-hitter by the Mariners. We've seen Johan Santana throw one, the first one in Mets history, and we've also seen Jarrett Weaver throw one for the Angels. So, you know, here's another one, and just for that alone, Matt Cain becomes my dog of the week. Since we also have some more time, and since the fellas decided to leave me in the press box by myself, I'm going to go ahead and give you the series of the week. And since we were talking about the San Francisco Giants, we're going to keep with that. And as well as that, with the other team that I have, obviously have a man crush on, as the fellas will tell you, the Los Angeles Dodgers. The Dodgers and the Giants, you know, a baseball rivalry that goes all the way back to New York with Duke Snyder and with Willie Mays. Now here they are again playing in the National League West, playing for first place. And, yes, the Dodgers are still in first place. And that's for you, RJ. So I am getting nice and ready for that pop we're going to talk about at the end of the year. But that's the series of the week. I've given you the dog of the week. Tune in again next week. The fellows will be back. We'll be in our regular spot, and we're going to bring it to you. We're going to be able to go back and forth all day, night long. So join us again next week, 9:30 Eastern, 8:30 Central. Drive home safe. Ball game over. And good night.